going, just because I know that there's lots of interesting stuff on the docket today. By way of role, maybe I'll just call a few folks whose names or images I didn't quite capture. Brian Flowers, are you with us on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Brian, thanks so much. And June, did I miss you?
I'm here.
Thank you, June. Sorry, I see you now. And Paul Lee.
Here.
Excellent. Well, with that then, I think, Roger, we've got a full sweep, full clean sweep of attendance. I guess then it's, I'm obliged to give you a little bit of an update of some things that have been going on, and it's been another busy period. So just a few items I thought I'd mention by way of the president's report. Some of this, at least some of you have heard me say a few remarks about in the past, so I'll just try and keep this tightly scripted so we can get to the really good stuff ahead. First of all, I guess I thought I'd mention again that we had a lovely celebration of Pro Bono Week, and especially the Pro Bono Partnership annual lunch on the 26th of October. I just wanted to say it was, again, just a really exceptional effort on behalf of the BAR team in putting together this virtual event. It was really a great opportunity to bring some folks together and to say thanks for some incredible efforts in the pro bono space. Daryl really made some fabulous remarks, sort of both in terms of their content, but also just sort of a gracious expression of appreciation to so many of our partners. And again, some of you have heard me say this, but the keynote remarks for the pro bono partnership for the luncheon itself were provided by Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta. She was interviewed by the Federal Pro Bono Program Coordinator or Director Laura Klein, and just really an inspiring set of remarks on the issue of sort of her experience with pro bono work historically, her efforts as they continue against current challenges. And again, I think the most poignant moment in the interview came in her discussion of the necessity of hope. And I interpreted it as sort of a functional necessity for lawyers writ large, but especially those who work in the pro bono space. And it was really sort of an uplifting, the most uplifting part of the discussion, I thought, in so many ways. In concert with that, there is a publication that I urge everyone to review, just because it's chock full of great information. It's sort of visually interesting and well-organized, and that is the Pro Bono Initiative Report. And it is 20 years on now, a sort of a digest of a major thrust of pro bono effort across the city. For those who are not familiar with it, again, it's been up and running since 2001. Currently, there are 69 signatory firms that participate in this initiative. And as part of their joining the initiative, they make a number of commitments, including to really sponsor a lot of pro bono effort at their firms, meeting certain minimum floors in terms of percentage of billable hours or in raw hours per attorney. They commit to sort of seeking out innovative ways of encouraging participation of their attorneys in the pro bono effort, and to constantly reassess and innovate as to how to increase those commitments, and then to respond back to the bar by way of describing what their efforts have looked like over the course of each year. And just a couple of really impressive statistics, I guess, that came out of this year's report. There was a record-breaking 1 million plus hours of pro bono work done in 2020. That's an incredibly high standard, and I think an impressive accomplishment that they can take great pride in, but really our profession can take great pride in. The 65 firms that responded of the 69 that are part of the initiative, the 65 that responded to at least some subset of the questions when you put all of the information together, offer some really interesting insights. More than 9,300 attorneys participated in this pro bono work. They worked an average of 91 hours. Each of the firms, attorneys rather, devoted something on average of 91 hours of pro bono work during 2020. There was an increase in the each firm's pro bono effort by an average of 85 hours as compared to the prior year's survey of effort. I think the statistic was that they contributed an average of 5.3% of their billable hours to the pro bono cases that they undertook, and that approximately 52%, but at least better than half of the pro bono time that was spent in DC proper, so to speak, was devoted to DC residents of limited means. And so again, it's an impressive underlying thing that's accomplished, but it's a really high quality report that gives you great insight into what we're actually doing and what the pro bono center and the bar is actually able to support in this space. So I urge you to take a look at it. It's you can find it readily on the pro bono section of the DC Bar's website. So I just thought it would be useful to share a couple of key insights from the initiative's report. I also wanted to highlight and give a real shout out to one of our own in the area of our voluntary bar leadership meetings, and in particular, some of the supporting materials and coordination that Rachna provides. Rachna, is she joining us today, Bob?
I don't think she's on today.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Well, again, I can't say enough about her efforts. This most recent meeting focused on a couple of different things. One was an effort to allow some of the voluntary bar leaders to discuss their efforts at delivering on and enhancing sort of the value proposition for their members. And so there were a lot of interesting insights about how to leverage, you know, this online world that we're still living in, and new and different ways to bring people together, both in a substantive way, but also socially. And, you know, you could see that folks are very much thinking creatively about how to keep the best of what we've found in these times and in this kind of two-dimensional space for what lies ahead. The other piece of the meeting this month focused on the ABA's Afghan Response Project. And that was something I've asked about on a couple of different occasions, just because it's nearer and dearer to the military part of my heart and my life. And so there was some fascinating insights that a couple of the gentlemen who are leading that effort for the ABA were able to provide in terms of what they're doing and what they hope to do moving forward. And there may be opportunities for the communities and sections potentially to provide some support there. So that'll be an ongoing effort, but it was just heartening to hear again about a particular flavor of volunteer work that our bar can be a part of. And so again, Rachna does an incredible job of teeing those meetings up and having them deliver on value, really delivering something substantive and meaningful for the voluntary bar leaders. Resourcing them with just a fabulous compendium of materials after each one of the meetings. And that really jumped out at me this month in particular. Another little bit of good news and a shout out that I thought I'd echo, and some of you may be aware of this already, but the Washington Lawyer, our own bar publication, just won the Luminary Award from NABBE. And they received the 2021 Luminary Award for Excellence in Regular Publications. And it's worth mentioning that this is like a heavily contested category. More than 30 bars nominate publications and various projects that they have up and running to compete for this award. And it is particularly notable that the judges for this award gave the Washington Lawyer the maximum number of points possible en route to that victory. It is Washington Lawyer's third industry award and the fourth time they were a finalist after being nominated for some flavor of recognition in the past 2 years. So I just think it's quite obviously a world-class editorial team and effort and publication. And, there's no surprise that, again, this came under the watchful eye of Jeff Kleinberg and the columns that he supported the Washington Lawyer with, not my own. I suppose the other thing I wanted to say about the Washington Lawyer while we're on the topic is if we have some history buffs out there, don't miss this month's, or I guess I should say the January, February edition, because it's got a really interesting retrospective on the bar's own past. So, but good on you to everybody who's involved in the Washington Lawyer, because, I am well advised that this is no mean feat to have won this award again, for that matter. I just thought I'd remind everybody that the Peyton Leadership Academy is accepting applications. There are a number of other things that folks can be nominated for that are, you know, we're starting up the nominations committee's work and that sort of thing. But the Peyton Leadership Academy has been reimagined and reinvigorated for, you know, sort of the times that we live in and work in. So again, if you've got candidates that you think would make for good applicants, we'd love to see those folks come out. And I guess maybe my final note, I'll just say, again, most of you heard me say this once before, but for those who may have missed our special meeting, I'll just say again, I really appreciated the opportunity to see so many of you and so many of you for the first time at the president's reception last month. It was really just a great event. It's amazing to finally, you know, have some social outlet and interaction. And if you haven't spent enough time at the building, you really should go. It's a big deal to have, you know, brought all of that to fruition. It's a story that isn't, you know, that story continues to evolve a little bit. But just the use of that space and I don't want this to be overly self-congratulatory, but when we host folks from other places and when we're able to put on, you know, substantively rich presentations that are enhanced because of the environment that they're happening in, it's just something that we can all take great pride in. And again, it's a value, a delivering value kind of proposition that you just can't argue with. So thanks for everyone for, you know, the amazing team of people that stand behind all those kinds of efforts at the bar itself. And some of you are on the line. And if for those who are not, please spread the good news that it's, I know it's also not like, it's not just the thing. You don't just show up at the building and great things happen. It's true that they happen when you show up at the building, but it's because of the great effort of so many people. So just the last note of thanks there, and I've already rambled on too much. Before I move on to our consent agenda though, was there any sort of question or follow-up on any of those topics? Something that I may have missed, some angle that I may have missed in mentioning those items? All right. Hearing none, then, if you've had an opportunity to look through the materials, you saw that we just had the draft minutes of our September 24th meeting in the consent agenda. And if there is a motion to adopt those, I'd certainly entertain that now.
Moved.
Any second?
Second.
I saw some raised hands. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, then we'll adopt those minutes. And without further ado then, Andrea, if you've got a treasurer's report, we'd love to have it.
I do, and just as a reminder, this is a license renewal update, not a full treasurer's report, which I will be providing next month in December. So now I'm reporting on the results of the bar's license renewal season for fiscal year 2022. To date, we've received $30.3 million in license fees. That's 2% less than the $31 million budget. We have 102,518 license fee paying members compared to 100,506 the same time last year. So about 2,000 additional fee paying members. It's an increase of 2%. We had 2,062 members in suspended status, and compared to last year, that's about 1,800 fewer suspensions, so a lot less. Since October 1st, 477 members are now back in good standing, and as a reminder, I will be reporting on the first quarter fiscal year results in 2020, fiscal year, first quarter 2022 fiscal year operational results for both the bar and the pro bono center next month at December's meeting. And that concludes my report.
Excellent. That, a lot of good news there. Thank you, Andrea. Sorry, Jeff.
No, I was just going to ask Bob whether you anticipate that the budget shortfall, although small, is going to be made up by those who have been suspended, who will come back in once they pay their dues again.
Right, it's likely to be the case. I mean, we are really pleased to see that we've got
really more than 1,000 fewer suspensions this year than we've had in past years. And then, of course, you know, once we get to the new folks being admitted, that will kick in some more after we get probably, you know, around January, once the November results come out and the folks start to actually go through the admissions process. So yes, we're not worried at all about the position we're in. In fact, we're in a better position than we were last year.
Excellent news. Thanks, Bob.
Oh, I just saw a question pop about how many folks got a waiver. I believe it's around, at the moment, for the folks who were suspended as a result, I think we're working about 9 or 10. We have about another 15 or so that are in the request process, if you will. So we're looking about 24, give or take, total. So it's not a huge number of people who've requested a COVID-related waiver or delay in the payments. On the CEO report, our operational status, I think you all know we are working on what we call a soft opening, which means the building is open if anyone wants to go to work, but we're not expecting folks to be in there other than those required to maintain the building. But what we do is we post a list of people who are coming in or planning on coming in so folks can see about what the density is going to be. We're only running at about, you know, a dozen to 20 people on any given day. So it's a fairly light group. Only vaccinated employees and visitors are allowed in the building. And we're not going to be scheduling any full-blown in-person events until at least February. And we'll sort of reassess where we are and go into the spring, hopefully with some hybrid events, both in-person and virtual. The virtual program is going well. And so we're not pressed on that score. Just a reminder that because of the vaccination requirement, we're using the Return Safe app. So if you do plan on going into the building, just make sure you, I know most of you, if not everyone, has already uploaded your vaccination information in there, but you have the daily screening that you do when you actually go into the building, and things seem to be working out pretty well. The nominations committee is off to a terrific start, and consistent with what we had discussed last spring and summer about upgrading our recruitment efforts, the nominations committee is already in full swing. They are working with our marketing communications team to develop a full-scale marketing effort, which has already begun. You may have seen emails that went out from me and Chad last week. We've got video testimonials from current and former board members and officers. We've got a social media kit, which is in your materials. We're enlisting the committee chairs from our many committees, as well as our past presidents, along with you, to help recruit in addition to the nominations committee. We already have 5 self-nominated candidates, including 1 candidate for president-elect. So things are off to a good start, and it's still very early, these are all very good signs. So hopefully the enhanced campaign will result in a really robust group of candidates. While the deadline is technically in January, we of course are urging everyone to nominate or self-nominate sooner rather than later, so that then the committee can know about how much further recruiting it's going to need to do. I've reached out to a number of you who are eligible to run again. And you know, I hope that you will consider doing so. And if you could let us know, so again, sooner rather than later, we just help the committee in its decision-making process going forward. We are going to hold a special membership meeting in the spring of 2022 to primarily renew the 3 resolutions that we have, where the members have authorized the board and the bar to speak out on 3 issues: filling court vacancies, sufficient court funding, and public funding for access to justice. We renew the members will give us, they have given us 5 years authorization to speak on these topics. And as you know, the board annually renews those resolutions, basically saying the members gave us permission to do this. And yes, we would like to be able to do this during the course of the coming year. But our 5 years are up this spring. We met last in the spring of 2017, and now we have to re-up the resolutions. In anticipation of that meeting, we have asked the DC Court of Appeals in a letter to Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby, which you have a copy of, to make a slight amendment to the rules governing the bar that would permit us to conduct that special membership meeting, as well as our annual membership meeting. not just in person the way the rule says right now, but also virtually or hybrid. And we're doing that obviously because of current conditions, and also because even there's a 100 member minimum for the special meeting. And even with our beautiful space, having 100, it could be more than that, obviously, members just show up in the building and deal with social distancing and conduct an effective meeting might be a little challenging. So we've asked the court for permission to do it virtually, and hopefully they will agree to that. I would suggest that the board consider, not necessarily at this meeting, but at one of the future meetings in December, January, whether or not another resolution might be put before the membership that would allow the board to speak on issues related to the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary. And the fundamental reason being, when these things pop up in sort of life and we want to respond to social events of the day, they are oftentimes so clouded in the politics of the moment that anything that the board does sort of reeks of politics. And having a blanket authorization in a calmer moment would then allow the board a little bit more flexibility. I mean, you still have to be mindful of referenda issues, First Amendment issues, and the rest, but it would at least be, would give you a little bit more flexibility to speak out when things happen in the world at large. Again, not for necessarily discussion today. We would want to look at specific language to think about, but given the fact that we are bringing the members together to have the special membership meeting, and because I know that over the past 2 years, the board has struggled a little bit with this, it might be a good time. And just so that you know, we have a draft a protocol for making those kinds of public statements that we'll be presenting to you to consider. We're just kind of fine tuning it around the edges before we give it to the board for its review, modification, editing, and the rest. So again, I just put that on your radar screen for the spring.
One mechanical question just with regard to the special meeting, silly question. Yeah. How large a group can the bar's largest space host, like if people decided to come out of the woodwork?
Yeah, so if you open up all of the walls of the conference center, and I will defer to Stacey Gray because she is the master of all things space related. I mean, it generally holds 350 people seated classroom style. So assuming you could maintain some kind of distancing, you probably get a couple of hundred people in there, but it would be a little bit challenging. You'd have to sort of set a limit about how many people could actually show up in person in terms of, like, for example, registering for the meeting, and then how many would be, you could have obviously, you know, hundreds and hundreds, about thousands virtually that would attend. Typically speaking, in the past, we've struggled to get 100 people to attend these meetings in person, but I think with a virtual component, we shouldn't have nearly the complicating factor. So, but we just need to get authorization from the court to do it.
Yeah, no, obviously I remember the letter. Yep.
Yeah.
Bob, hi, it's Ellen. Just to follow up, in terms of timing, if the board decides to ask authorization for this additional issue, kind of what's the timing, and is there any notice we need to give to the membership? Or
yeah, we would need to give the note, the advance, when we put out the notice of the meeting, and I forget what the number, how many days it is, whether it's 60 days or 90 days before the meeting, we would need to know of all the resolutions, even the ones that are already existing, what the language is going to be. So again, we haven't set the date yet, and it would be great to hear from the Court of Appeals about at least their inclination about changing the rules, so that way it'd give us some flexibility about planning and getting the word out. But there is a notice requirement before we have that meeting.
Right, but it's no different than the notice for renewing the
Correct.
Issues we already can speak on. Okay, thank
exactly
you.
Exactly the same.
Yeah, thanks.
And then my last note here is just a reminder about the communications protocol. We do have some very chatty members who will sometimes hit up one or more of you on questions related to operations or bar admissions or bar or lawyer discipline. And your first stop, we would urge you to make it Iram, who will then direct it to where it needs to be or address it herself, since a lot of these questions actually tend to fall into her wheelhouse. Also, we do have members who will ping you individually. And like almost, if they don't like the answer they get number one, then they'll go to number two. And having all of it go to Irem centrally helps us help you making sure that they've got one consistent, clear response. Again, a lot of these things are either operationally driven or relate to other entities where we don't have a whole lot of control, but we have contacts. So we can get the information to the relevant parties that need it.
As a serial user of that new protocol, I can tell you, from my perspective at least, it's been very effective in keeping us all on sort of one page and actually delivering a substantive and sometimes helpful, acceptable, satisfying response for the member. So I guess I should say thank you, Irm, for stewarding that, because it's worked, I think, very well.
And that's it for me, unless anyone has any questions.
Any questions for Bob? All right, then. Well, it's a pleasure now to be able to turn to Mark Salzberg for a report from our Regulation and Rules Committee in a bit of discussion about where we are with our bylaws effort. Thanks, Mark.
Can you hear me okay?
Hear you perfectly.
Okay, excellent. Good morning, everybody. As you may know, the Regulations Rules Committee has been engaged for the past year or so in a process to revise the bar bylaws. We've met monthly. We've been greatly assisted by bar staff and Nancy Sylvester, who is a parliamentarian who joins us today. Everyone should have a parliamentarian in their back pocket. We have multiple goals in this effort. The bylaws, we think, should be readable. They should be easy to understand. They should be decluttered. Extraneous materials should be included in external documents and moved out of the bylaws if possible. And the bylaws should be consistent with Robert's rules. This is the best practice from a parliamentarian perspective. And Nancy will correct me if I'm wrong. We expect to have a final report to the board and recommendation for the entire modification to the bylaws in January. But we have reached consensus right now on 7 articles. These 7 articles have been highlighted in the changes that we recommend have been highlighted in a memorandum sent to the board on November 9th. We had 2 attachments. We had a clean version of these new articles, as well as an attachment which showed modifications to Article 7, which addresses the committee. I don't know if any members of the board have any specific questions, although I'm happy to walk the board on a high level through the proposed changes, whatever is most time effective and what the board would like to do. Does the board have a specific request along those lines?
Question. This is Megan. Chad, I saw you also unmuted. Did you want to go ahead, Chad?
No, I was hoping that, look, I've had the benefit of participating in most of these efforts, so I'm glad that someone who is not has a view.
Yeah, no, it's just a question, and I apologize if I missed it, but in reading this over the weekend, the proposal to change around the minimum attendance required to vote and the minimum number of, I was just wondering a little bit about the basis for that. Is it to align us more with certain best practices? Is it because we've had challenges in this area in the past? I just was wondering.
It's funny, Irm and I just had a conversation a little while ago about that very change. I think, and Irm, you can add if I misstate this, I think the idea here is to make it more workable, I guess. We've modified the minimum attendance from presently 14 to 11 with the same number of votes to approve an amendment. I think this facilitates more decisions. It facilitates proposed amendments to the bylaws. But Irm, do you want to walk the committee, or I'm sorry, the Board of Governors through the math a little bit? You're on mute.
Not everyone can read lips after 18 months of being on mute. Thanks, Megan. So the proposal is to change the quorum requirement right now for a bylaw amendment. Right now, under the rules, if the board is going to vote on a bylaw amendment, 14 voting members need to be there, which is different from the regular quorum requirement. And so today, in effect, we have kind of 3 different quorum requirements. We have a quorum that's required to start a meeting, which is, I think, 9. We have 11 if the board wants to conduct business. And then if the board wants to vote on a bylaw amendment, there's got to be 14 people in the room. So to streamline and make that consistent, in order to vote on bylaws or conduct any other business, and you'll see the quorum requirement in the BOG article when you see that in December. So we're just going to create a baseline. So the quorum now is 11 to start a meeting, conduct business. But what we're changing is instead of a majority vote to approve a bylaw amendment, we're requiring a 2/3 vote to approve a bylaw amendment. So for general business, you need a majority vote as long as you have a quorum. But for a bylaw amendment, you need 2/3 provided that you have a quorum. So I hope that answers your question. And so I'll stop talking.
Yeah, no, thank you. That helps to put it in perspective. So thank you so much for the additional information.
Thanks, Hiram. Are there any other specific questions? Again, I can walk through on a general basis a summary of the proposed recommendations to these 7 articles, or I can address any specific additional questions that anyone has.
Maybe if there are other questions based upon folks' prior reading of the materials, that would be great to maybe tackle as a priority. If there are no other questions, look, there's been a ton of fabulous work done here, and at least hitting those high notes might be a good next step, Mark.
Okay. Well, I'd say in summary fashion, you'll see the proposed recommendations, Article 1, just to name the organization, Article 2, the purpose of the bar. These are to bring the bylaws in line with Robert's rules. The more substantive changes would be the one that Megan just referenced, as well as Article 7, which identifies the committees. And what we've done is, this is a good example of decluttering. We've revised, we've shortened and streamlined. These changes are shown in Attachment B to the memorandum. What we've done is we propose to have 3 new sections: a description of the powers that the board can assign to the committees, a description of the duties of 3 select committees, those are audit, finance, and budget, and then a grant to the board of power to create additional committees. Materials relating to materials in the current section of the bylaws relating to committees will be moved to the committee charters or other governance documents. So this allows for details regarding composition, structure, rules of procedure to be moved into these other documents, and they can be modified from time to time without going through the process of modifications of the bylaws. This is, as Nancy could add in if she'd like, this is consistent with the concept of Roberts, where you have bylaws which addresses the most key issues, and then the other issues then are dealt with on the other documents, which are easily modifiable. So that's one of the important changes. Let's see. Also, I'd like to point out Article 9. We have set aside, again, this is best practices consistent with Roberts, setting forth that Roberts rules is now, it's a standalone article. This is consistent with Roberts. It specifically provides that Roberts rules governs not just the meetings, but also the bar proceedings as well. We have indemnification procedures in Article 11. There have been no substantive changes recommended so far. And again, to the extent that we have any modifications to any of these, we'll bring them before the board. We'll let the Board of Governors know before a final vote, obviously, in January. And finally, we have created a new standalone Article 12, best practices for Roberts, to have essentially a kind of a miscellaneous article. It just addresses miscellaneous topics. At this point, the only thing that we have in there right now is a definition of the fiscal year. So those are the proposed modifications that we have recommended right now. We are continuing to work on the other 5 or so articles, and we anticipate, again, bringing everything before the board for final approval based on our recommendations in January of next year. that kind of high level summary. Does anyone have any questions about any specific articles?
You.
Diane's got her hand raised.
Okay. Hi, Dan.
Hi. This is just me being such an annoying lawyer. So when we, do we have to then create, I agree with the uncluttering, I like all that, but do we have to actually take action to create all these committees that are being taken out? Like, is there some way that if they already exist, they continue to exist? And then do they have like a shelf life where they have to be renewed periodically or they sunset by themselves? I just don't know how that works procedurally. I know that's an annoying question, but I was curious. Once they're out of the bylaws, where do they go?
That's not an annoying question. I don't think there's going to be any sunset, and there's going to be no need. I have to think through this further and look at the rule, but I don't think there's going to be need for them to be re-upped. The board is given the authority under the third new provision in this article to create the committees. The committees will have their own governance documents, and so those documents will, you know, address how and how long the committees exist. I don't think there's going to be a time frame unless there are committees in existence right now that are specifically set to sunset.
Okay. I just didn't know how that would work. Like, fine. If we have to do something to create them.
I don't believe we're going to have to do anything to recreate the committees that are now in existence.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Nancy.
I just wanted to add that to keep in mind that one of the reasons, there's lots of reasons to take all of the clutter out of the bylaws. I think the greatest reason is because the longer the bylaws are, the less likely they are to be read by the members. And so we want to take, and the bylaws are simply the important rules that you all believe, no matter what, have to stay. And the only way you can change them is to amend them. So nothing can be suspended that's in the bylaws. So when you have that detail in the bylaws, you can't even suspend it. And it doesn't matter why you want to, you just can't. So that's one of the reasons we want to get them out of the bylaws and into other documents.
As I said, it's good to have a parliamentarian on retainer.
Sorry, Mark.
Yes, Chef.
Maybe it's worth also just addressing a little bit what role the board will have in reviewing, approving, developing the series of sort of secondary documents that we talked about. I know there's a membership manual that's being contemplated. There are perhaps some other governance manuals into which all this detail is going to be put. But one thing that I'm not clear on is exactly what the expectations are for the board's role in those sorts of documents.
My understanding, and Irm can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is we will, the next step in this process will be an amendment, if necessary, well, to the rules. And then we have to create the membership manual, which would be brought before the board for approval. That is obviously going to be the next step in this process. You're on mute again.
I'm nodding my head because I don't need to say anything else. That's exactly right, Mark. And Jeff, just so you know, a lot of these things are being created simultaneously as well. And so there will be another kind of presentation in December of a select group of articles. And then in January, the board will see everything all at once. And that'll be the proposed revised bylaws, the new membership manual. And if there's any other companion document, that will also be there. So it'll kind of come as a package, but we wanted to kind of take you along this walk with us as we get to the final stages and the committee's final report.
And again, to the extent that we have any changes to the articles we've addressed in the memorandum of November 9, we'll bring them before the Board of Governors again in January, and we'll let you know. Nancy.
I just wanted to mention that the board is not losing authority over any of this, any of the documents. It's just making it so that you're not voting on every minor change and having to deal with it. For example, the membership manual can be changed by another, by the membership division, it is given to the executive committee of the board, who then, if they say, nope, we don't like it, we want that to go to a vote of the board. So it's all, your role in all of this hasn't been diminished. It has just been made much, much easier.
Yeah, again, just to echo some of the prior sort of comments about process, it has really been a thoughtful and meticulous approach in going through the documents. It is outstanding to have a knowledgeable parliamentarian to guide so many of those discussions. And it really is a fabulous reorganization and simplification of the documents that will make them all that much more user-friendly, not just for the board, but also for the members.
Chad, can I just follow up on something that Nancy said, just to make sure I understand and the board understands? Right now, what's in the bylaws, the board has to vote on to change. When things get moved into the membership manual, as Nancy says, the board will still have oversight, but it may be in a slightly, it sounds like, different way, as opposed to the full board voting on a change in the membership manual. It now may be a process of an approval by the executive committee. So a division of the board will still have authority, but it may be a streamlined kind of process, maybe not the full board. Just so people understand that when we see the packet with all of the governance documents. Is that right, Nancy? Did I summarize that accurately?
Well said.
Thank you.
Well then, okay. Any other questions for Mark or for Nancy? Well, hearing none.
All right.
Then we'll say thank you again for all the work you're doing, Mark, and stewarding with the committee.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a good day, everyone.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Then I guess we can turn next to Jessica for a report with regard to the screening committee's latest efforts. And there's a lot going on there, too.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Apologies in advance. I have construction upstairs, so I apologize for any noise, the joys of working from home. So first is the Neighborhood Legal Services Program. I'm guessing we don't have much discussion on that. The committee recommended to go with the recommendations from the Board of Directors. So I'm guessing the next topic is going to have more discussion, but if anyone wants to talk about those, let me know. And Chad, am I asking for a vote at this point, or do we wait till we finish everything?
Well, I suppose that there could be a different result or a different approach with regard to each set of nominations. So unless it strikes anybody as appropriate to do otherwise, maybe we'll take a vote with respect to Neighborhood Legal Services first, and then move to the Judicial Nominations Commission.
Okay, that works for me.
So yeah, if there is a motion to adopt the recommendations with regard to the Neighborhood Legal Services appointments, I'd entertain that now.
So moved.
A second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, then those are approved, and we'll move on to the Judicial Nomination Commission discussion.
Okay. So I understand there are a lot of different opinions and interests here. I will tell you some of what went into our thoughts in recommending Aida Ford, who seems very impressive and qualified in our opinion. So we considered 16 applicants for one vacancy. Currently, the JNC has 5 men and 2 women. And John McAvoy is ending his term, so we are filling his term. So we had 10 women and 6 male applicants, which included different backgrounds, including law school, public service, and private practice. We narrowed it down to about five or six top candidates based on their qualifications, the applications, recommendations, and at least half of those were men. But we definitely were in favor of having a woman because there are, again, five men and two women. So some of the things that we were very impressed with Yaita Ford included her varied background, including private practice, DC government, and legal aid. She has extensive experience in the courts, which we thought was very important. She has geographic diversity within the district. All the applicants have to live in DC, and she is an alumni of Howard Law, which we found to be impressive. So we were not really worried about when people applied so much as their qualifications. So that is a summary of our considerations. So I'm sure there is some discussion that people want to have. So go ahead.
Jessica, this is Natalie. I think that's an awesome, awesome recommendation. I think she's total. I think Aida is great. So I think that's great.
This is Sally. I have a question for the committee. Jack McAvoy is coming off, and he's the person we are replacing. Addie Schmidt is concluding her term in January. With that, and if Ms. Ford is proposed by us, did the committee consider the absence of racial diversity on the commission?
I don't understand your question. So can we consider the lack of racial diversity?
Did you consider the lack of racial diversity? If Ms. Ford joins the commission, six of the members will be African-American. Addie Schmidt is white. She is rotating off. The White House, at least as of a week and a half ago, had not notified Addie that she would be renominated. And so I don't know who the seventh person would be. Also, just to be clear, there are two women on the commission now. Addie is one of them. She is rotating off unless the White House renominates her. The other person, Marie Johns, is not a lawyer. She's a woman, but she's not a lawyer. So without Addie, there would be no woman lawyer on the commission. So I agree. I think that's something to be particularly cognizant of. But I also think we have to look at the commission as a whole and figure out, you know, who is going to work best in terms of providing not only qualifications, but qualified diversity.
I mean, I don't know who's supposed to answer this, but I will say we were not particularly looking for a white person. We were not, that was not one of our considerations. We were trying diversity in many aspects, but to diversify, it wasn't our goal to try to find a white woman.
I guess I'll amplify that comment slightly by way of saying, as I recall our conversation, Sally, that possibility did, you know, sort of the diversity picture that you described, that possibility did occur to us. But, you know, it's just a complicated picture given the number of nominating entities, and there's what we can control and what we can't. Obviously, we can control this appointment in the moment, but really what was, I think what drove our consideration was a broader view of diversity, right? And I think there was a lot of discussion about what the experience, well, it's all the things that Jessica already, there's no reason to rehash what Jessica already described. That kind of substantive, and to a certain extent, personal diversity, but that kind of substantive diversity also really drove the conversation. There was serious consideration. I mean, it was a real debate, so to speak, as to what the right direction was to go. So at least in my recounting of how our deliberations went, there were at least two other candidates who were given very serious consideration. And it's just, you know, when we came down to sort of the margins of considering who presented the broadest number and variety of qualifications that seemed to fit the bill, Aida just rose to the top. It doesn't really fully address the possibility that you describe, but it is a possibility that we're not fully in control of either.
Well, we have a role.
We have a vote. We have a vote right now, no question.
And we had a vote last time. So anyway, I don't want to get too far, although I'm happy to, into the comparative merits. Again, I would make a pitch for somebody who has basically on a daily basis been in superior court and really understands what the court does and what the judges do. I do not think, I think that there are at least two other candidates who meet that far better. So now I'll be quiet because I see Susie's got her hand up.
Please, Susie.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I think I understand that there are competing kind of considerations for filling this slot. Gender is definitely one of them. Racial makeup is one of them, but I really feel like for this particular entity, we really need to consider a member who has legal services experience and practice in DC Superior Court in the high volume and, you know, parts of the court where there's a large number of pro se litigants. It's such a major part of a judge's time with DC Superior Court that unfortunately many of them, I think, that's not the part that they want to practice in. They want to be in criminal, where both sides are represented by counsel, and they're just waiting for that time when they can like get, you know, put in that part of the court. So I think it's really important for someone who has had that experience, and as Sally put it, on a regular basis in DC Superior Court. It's one of the reasons why I was excited, both excited and disappointed, excited that Deborah Epstein was chosen to fill a vacancy, and then disappointed that she had to resign because she moved out of the district. When we had to fill her vacancy, Vince Cohen, was presented as the person to fill that. At that time, I didn't raise this issue because, we were told this is time sensitive. And so my hope was with this position, we could basically fill, I think, the void that Deborah has left. Deborah, in charge of the, has had years of experience supervising the domestic violence clinic at Georgetown, and so has that experience in one part of the court, and really, I think, has a deep understanding of what happens in those high volume, high pro se litigant courts, and what judges need to be prepared to do in those parts of the court. I do feel like there are applicants who meet that requirement or bring in that experience and perspective, and really think that they should be considered for this vacancy.
Yeah, not particularly advocating for any individual or any alternative, I suppose. But I'll just say again, this was a very fulsome discussion about all of the candidates with emphasis on several different people. And it was not easy to arrive at the place that we did. And look, at the end of the day, this board has an opportunity and an obligation. The screening committee has provided its best recommendation on the basis of the candidates and the discussion and the assessment of the opportunities that each of the candidates presented here. This board can accept that recommendation or it can reject it and send the committee back to do further business. And so, you know, that's really just procedurally, that's the opportunity that's now before the board. But I see at least a couple of other hands up. So Ellen, I think I saw yours first. Let me turn to you.
Thank you, Chad. And I'll be brief. I guess I just wanted to address Sally's question again, which is we didn't particularly think about the racial makeup. I think at the time, as Jessica said, we were very focused on wanting a woman in this position. And what tipped us toward Aida, I think, were a couple things. One was her extensive experience. There were some candidates who were very attractive that were younger, less experienced, and we decided we wanted someone with more experience in this position. I think we also were looking at other forms of diversity in terms of background. We liked the fact that she was a solo. We had some other great candidates who were from larger, more established law firms and just decided that, you know, we wanted that type of diversity as well. And we have said before, this is a workhorse position. You know, our appointees on this commission bear the brunt of the work. And we felt that through her existing work on bar committees, Aida had definitely shown her chops, that she is willing to, you know, lift a heavy weight. That said, as Chad has said, this is the board's appointment. So if there are other factors that the board would like to consider, then we should have that discussion. And I don't know, Chad, if it's, you know, how if the board can just vote on it now or the screening committee goes back and considers it. But this is the forum to discuss if there are other factors that the board feels should be weighed more heavily than the screening committee did.
Yeah, but look, we have every opportunity to discuss what we think is an appropriate sort of weighting of perspectives or review. And, you know, part of that will be useful for the committee to hear if there's more work to be done, but it's also informing the vote that we'll take at some point in the very near future, right? Before we do any of that, I certainly want the discussion to have a full opportunity to breathe. I see Amy's got her hand up. And before I turn to you, Amy, just to finish out some of the kinds of remarks that you made, Ellen, just in terms of things that rose to the top with regard to Aida. I think the other thing worth mentioning is Aida does have some substantial legal aid experience of her own. I think close to 4 years of experience in that arena, and that, you know, that was again something that was on our radar screen. So whether that or how that weighs into the sort of complicated calculus we've got here, that's very, I suspect, very individual and subjective. But Amy, let me turn to you.
Thanks, Chad. I wanted to echo 2 points that I think are important for this role. One is that that the candidate have extensive experience practicing in DC Superior Court before the bench. And I, you know, looking at Ms. Ford's resume, I noticed that the legal aid time, it looks like it was mostly administrative, maybe Office of Administrative Hearings, and not so much in DC Superior Court. There's another candidate I wanted to bring to our attention, Amanda Korber, who is currently the housing supervisor at Legal Aid, who's been there for 6 years and has been practicing in the housing court for 6 years, and I think has a robust understanding of civil rights, particularly around housing. And I would like to just highlight both her experience and, again, what Susie said, the importance of promoting someone who has extensive legal services experience.
Thanks very much for that additional information, Amy. And again, I can't stress enough that this was not a process that sort of easily or immediately eliminated any candidates. Each really did receive some significant amount of thought. Speaking of being thoughtful, I appear to have not been so thoughtful. Brian, I missed your hand up, I think. So let me turn to you next.
Brown hand on the back, not down. I do have a basic question though, and that is Jack McAvoy. Is he timing out on the commission, or is he not seeking renomination, reelection?
He is timing out. That's correct, Brian.
But he has offered to serve again.
Yeah, he's one of the candidates that the committee actually talked about. Right, he was on the list.
Okay. Well, I just want to say I'm prepared to support the screening committee's selection because I haven't gotten into the weeds obviously with these other candidates, but I assume the screening committee has. And I mean, unless we're gonna become the screening committee, I'm prepared to defer to their judgment on this. But that's just my two cents here.
Thank you, Brian. No, I appreciate that perspective. Susie, I think your hand is up again. Yes. Sorry, you're on mute. We can't hear you.
Sorry. Side but related note. You know, Sally had mentioned that Addie is up, and I guess she's the White House's pick. And I'm just wondering, does the bar have any type of influence with the White House about, you know, who they choose, or we're just really just, they do what they want to do and it's an independent decision?
Yeah, it's, we have no role in that. Or the other, quite frankly, the other appointees as well, whether the mayor's appointee, we just don't have a role. And so all the only people we can control are our own appointees.
Sally, I see your hand up as well.
Yes, I agree that Amanda is very impressive. However, again, I think for this position, we need someone with more seniority. And I would say somebody who's been practicing law at least 10 years would be kind of my threshold. But I would hope that Amanda would be somebody in a few years, frankly, that would consider being on the court herself, let alone being on the JNC. And I take Brian's point that we should not be substituting ourselves for the screening committee, but I am also somewhat concerned that perhaps everybody did not read everything that was submitted on behalf of the candidates. And again, I don't want to, I have some concerns about people's philosophy of who should be on the bench. There's at least one candidate who apparently feels that as long as the judge has a lot of discretion, that's the kind of person we want on the bench. And I personally think for somebody on Superior Court, we want somebody who can read the law and apply the law. So, I mean, it may be a philosophical difference, but I would hope that everybody realizes the importance of this selection. And if you don't realize it, pick up the Washington Post this morning and read the almost full page article about what it's like to be on the JNC.
So. Yeah, I can't reiterate enough. I appreciate those comments, Sally. I can't reiterate enough how in many respects, the conversation we're having here mirrors a lot of the conversations that the committee itself had. I not my position or obligation or preference to defend the, you know, what brought the committee to this recommendation particularly, but I do want to assure everyone, as I think Jessica would, that there was a robust discussion of all of the candidates, and it at least seemed to me, and I'm just speaking on my own behalf, my own perspective here, that those discussions were well informed, at least on the basis of the materials that were provided. And there were some helpful additional bits of information that some members of the committee were able to bring to the discussion based upon the outside experiences with some of these folks. And I think it's fair to say that none of that information predominated the discussion. It was really a substantive discussion about the candidates themselves and an effort to wrestle with all of the many factors that we're talking about here. And while I think the committee felt very, very strongly and good about the recommendation it came to, I think it's not inconsistent with that view to say that the committee felt like it was and perhaps would be impossible to come up with a candidate that really hit all of the marks in sort of an equally satisfying way. This is an incredibly complex picture that we're painting here with the with the recommendation that was made. That was not lost upon the committee. And I don't think the committee undertook this work lightly, nor do I think it would undertake if this recommendation is not accepted by the board. I don't think the committee would have any hesitation about trying to understand the views presented here and going back to the drawing board. But just understand, I want to be clear that there was no lack of effort to wrestle with these kinds of considerations that we're all having now then. And we are replaying the work of the screening committee to some extent with these discussions. Not that it's not helpful to do, because everybody needs to be informed before they cast their vote. That said, Natalie, I see your hand up.
Just briefly, having engaged with AIDA in other forums with the Metropolitan Washington Employment Lawyers Association, she's also on the board of the Washington Council of Lawyers. I know of AIDA. She knows the folks in DC. She knows who the decision makers are. She really has her ear to the ground in terms of the city, in terms of the court system. She has actively litigated in cases, not just in DC Superior Court, but elsewhere. I think she really has a broad landscape of knowledge and practice experience, not just with legal aid, but as a managing partner of her own small firm, which I think gives her sort of that managerial quality as well to understand, you know, how to manage different aspects of the city and also manage the political aspects of the position. But I don't think that there's anything in terms of her biography and experience that would that should leave someone with the impression that she's not actively practicing within the court system and not actively knowledgeable about judges and, you know, having that practical experience in the courts. I think she's very active in the court system and she's been very active in the DC bar for many years. So she just really brings a complete plate of experience in all areas. So I think she's a fantastic choice, and I'm not surprised that she's the selection here.
Well, this has been, I think, a productive discussion. Oh, I'm sorry, Brian, your hand is up. I see it.
You're muted, Brian.
Yeah, I'm want to offer the motion to approve the committee's recommendation. We want experience. We've got Ellen Huvel. We've got Jack McAvoy. So that's all. Motion to approve the committee's recommendation.
Okay. With that, I hear a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. All those opposed, please say nay.
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 Okay, I see three opposed. I didn't get a good count of the ayes, but the ayes have it. So with that, the recommendation of the screening committee with regard to the Judicial Nomination Commission will be approved.
Tad, would you just note my abstention, please?
I'm sorry, thanks, Ted, appreciate that. Plus one is abstention. With that bit of business concluded then, thank you again, Jessica, for providing the report of the committee and for helping us entertain this discussion. And with that, we are prepared to move into our executive session, which I guess means we've got to give a moment for some folks to drop off. And for those that are departing the call, let me just say again, thank you very much for your efforts and for joining us for this portion.